This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. A while back, we asked you, our audience, to submit your questions about Islam. One submission we received concerns the different Muslim practices around the world. We're joined by Muhammad Khalil. He's a professor of religious studies at Michigan State University, also director of the Muslim Studies Program and adjunct professor of law. Muhammad Khalil, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Gordon.
So give us as basic of an overview as you can, or as brief an overview as you can, of the Muslim population as it is dispersed around the world right now.
Sure. So there are over 1.5 billion Muslims in the world, making it the second largest religion in the world, also one of the fastest growing, if not the fastest growing religion in the world. You know, Muslims are all over the place. You know, often people tend to think of Muslims as Arab, but in fact, maybe 20% at most are Arab. The vast majority of Muslims are non-Arab. The country with the largest Muslim population is Indonesia in the Far East, followed by India, even though it's majority Hindu, followed by Pakistan, followed by Bangladesh. And none of those are Arab countries. So the first thing that we have to make clear is that most Muslims are actually non-Arab. Beyond that, there's a lot of diversity when it comes to interpretations of Islam. Now, that's always been the case. In fact, when you look at our sources on early Islamic history, we see that the earliest Muslims had differing opinions on things, and sometimes those differing opinions were considered all acceptable. You know, one of the famous stories is the Prophet Muhammad telling his followers not to pray a certain prayer, the third prayer of the day, until they reach a city. Well, as they're going to the city, they realize they're going to miss the timing for that prayer. So there's a debate. One side says we should pray now. Another side says, no, we should wait until we get there. And in the end, Muhammad says, you were both right. So there's always been diversity. And in the realm of Islamic law, there's been incredible diversity. And this is, I think, one of the unfortunate misconceptions that we see out there, where when people talk about Sharia law, as if Sharia law is one thing. In fact, there are numerous interpretations of Sharia. And when you look at early Islamic history, so in the fourth Islamic century, there was a scholar who looked at all the issues. He compiled a list of all the issues Muslim scholars agreed on. And it's, you know, published today. It's a slim volume, 166 pages or so. And in the same century, another scholar compiled a list of all the issues Muslims disagreed on. And it was a voluminous, a huge work. And I bet you if someone were to do the same project today, what Muslims agree on would be a pamphlet, and what they disagree on, you'd have enough books to fill Spartan Stadium. There are some things Muslims agree on. You know, there's one God, prayer is good, we should give to the poor. There's some basic things Muslims agree on, but there's a lot of diversity in how they understand Islam and how they understand how they practice their rituals.
So are there major sects or denominations of Islam that break down in certain ways, maybe don't cover 100% of Muslims, mm-hmm. but give us an idea yeah. of how many groups of people may interpret the Quran, etc.?
So there are two major sects, Sunni and Shi'i or Shiite. And the majority are Sunni, maybe 80 to 90%. Usually you hear 85 to 90% are Sunni. And then 10 to 20 or 15 to 20% are Shi'i or Shi'ite. What's the difference between the two? Basically, it comes down to this one question. How do you preserve the integrity of the religion in the absence of Muhammad, the Prophet Muhammad, who dies in 632 of the Common Era? What do you do in his absence? How do you preserve Islam? So for the Shia or Shiite, you know, again, this is a significant minority, 15 to 20%, they would look to the family of the Prophet. For the Sunni majority, they would look to the community at large, the Muslim community at large. And over time, the two actually begin to, you know, they're very similar in many ways. They're more similar than they are different. And they actually evolve in similar ways over time. But in some ways, a political difference. In some ways, it's a theological difference. And, you know, one thing I think it's important to stress here is that, you know, all too often we hear on the news, you know, these guys have been fighting for, you know, over 1,000 years. You know, Sunnis have been fighting Shiites. That's not accurate. There have been, you know, long spans of time where there has been peace between these groups. I hate to say it, but, you know, for a long time in Iraq under Saddam Hussein, even though Saddam Hussein persecuted many Shiites, Sunni-Shiite relations were not nearly as tense as they are now. There was actually relative calm. So Sunni-Shiite relations are complicated. You know, I have Sunni relatives who are married to Shiites, to Shiites. As I say, they're more similar than they are different, ultimately.
What about orientations?
Yeah, and okay, so beyond the major theological sects, Sunni and Shiite, and there are others, by the way, that are really rather small, but in any case, those are the big two. Now, with regard to orientation, so one major orientation is Sufism, or Sufi Islam. Sufism is sometimes defined as mysticism. And I always tell my students, that's not the best definition. Sufism can be defined as the attempt to perfect oneself and to arrive at a deeper understanding of God. And there are different kinds of Sufism, different orientations within Sufism. One of them is a mystical orientation where people try to experience God. And so it's common for mystical Sufis to come together and maybe have some music and say chants as they try to remember God. And one famous example of this is the whirling dervish, right? So they come together, they try to reflect on God, say God's name again and again and again, and to experience God. That's one major orientation. What percentage of Muslims are Sufi? It's hard to tell. And again, part of the problem is that there are different kinds of Sufis. You know, some are mystical, some might be aesthetic Sufis. They're not so interested in maybe experiencing God, feeling God, but they just want to get closer to God. They want to be God conscious, and so they try to live an upright life, and they try to avoid the material world and so on. So you have Sufism. Now you also have Salafism. That's another major orientation. Salafism, the goal of Salafism is to affirm the reality and oneness of God and to avoid anything that would compromise that. And Salafis have a reputation of being conservative. Now, historically, Salafis, you actually have liberal Salafis historically. I'm speaking here of, let's say, the early 1900s. But over time, that we typically use the term Salafi to refer to somebody with maybe a conservative orientation. You see Salafi thinking in a place like Saudi Arabia, where also you also use another term there, Wahhabism, where certain forms of Sufi practice would be considered prohibitive. And so those are two major orientations, Salafism and Sufism. I should just point out that Salafism, you typically see that among Sunnis, the Sunni majority. Sufism, you could actually see that among Sunnis and Shiites.
So if we take a look around the world, are there certain geographic trends? Are there certain places where we're more likely to find certain sects, certain orientations? And are those in neighboring countries, or do we have situations where you can have countries right next to each other with very different populations of sects and very different orientations?
Well, you know, it's interesting. It's really complicated. So when we think of Salafis, we typically think of Saudi Arabia. But Saudi Arabia has many Shiites and many Sufis. They might not be recognized by the government, or they might not be able to practice their religion fully or their understanding of religion, you know, their way of Islam fully. But they're there in significant numbers in Saudi Arabia. You know, even within each country, you have typically a lot of diversity. But I will say that there are certain, you could say, stereotypical or general trends. So, for instance, in West Africa, Sufism is more out there in the open. It's celebrated in the open, whereas in Saudi Arabia, that would not be the case. One thing I think it's important to stress here also is that when people tend to think of Islam, they tend to focus on specific countries like Saudi Arabia, like Iran. But, you know, those are just two countries out of many. So when we look at Saudi Arabia and Iran, we see that, okay, women in those countries are required to cover their hair, typically. But those are the only two major countries that require that. Yeah, there are certain regions where maybe that's women are required as well, but those are the two major nation states, Muslim majority nation states, that require women to cover their hair. Everywhere else, it's pretty much up to the person, up to the woman. You know, we tend to focus on those two countries, but in fact, there are so many other tendencies that we tend to miss when we look beyond Saudi Arabia and Iran. And by the way, Iran is majority Shiite or Shi'i. Saudi Arabia is majority Sunni.
So our question asker actually began with this statement: there are as many Islams as there are cultures throughout the world. There is not one Islam, and all are as valid as the others. So based on your research and scholarship, is that first part accurate? And is that second part where he says they're all valid? Would there be debate about that validity amongst Muslim leaders and scholars?
Yeah, absolutely, there would be debate. And I will say this. I find that Sufis are more likely, not necessarily, but they are more likely to accept competing orientations, competing interpretations of Islam, which is not to say that Sufis are all tolerant and open-minded, but I have found that they are more likely to be accepting of competing interpretations than, let's say, maybe Salafis are. And again, I don't want to overgeneralize, because in my own lifetime, I have seen exceptions to those to those tendencies. But there are certainly many Islams. You know, as I say, there are some things that Muslims agree on. There are some basic things that are Islam in the singular, the idea of one God and so on, the idea of an afterlife, the importance of prayer and giving to the poor. There are some basic things that constitute a single Islam. But once you go beyond that, I mean, just take the example of prayer. How should I pray? When should I pray? You're going to find so many different interpretations among Muslims. And it's always, I think, interesting to see Muslims praying side by side, because just look at where they place their hands. Some will place their hands on their heart. Some will place their hands maybe closer to their stomach. Others will put their hands down by the side. So there's great diversity. But if you're looking at the core beliefs, it's safe to say there is a single Islam with regards to core beliefs. But beyond that, again, incredible diversity.
Part of the reason we launched this idea of trying to get questions from our audience is that we thought that there might be a lot of misperceptions out there or a lot of confusion about what Islam is. As someone who studies this for a living and has written a couple books, would you agree that that for a lot of, say, non-Muslims, you know, American religion is made up, of course, of lots of things, but there's a lot of Christians, of course. Would you say that for those, religions in America that are non-Muslim, that there's a lot of confusion, a lot of misperceptions about what it means to be a Muslim?
Absolutely. Right now I'm working on a book on jihad and radicalism, and violent radicalism. And one of the things I noticed is that there is a common perception that groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda represent true Islam, that they are faithful Muslims. They are more faithful than other Muslims, that they actually take scripture seriously, whereas all other Muslims do not. If you encounter a good Muslim, they're good in spite of their religion, not because of their religion. And I think that's one of the most dangerous misconceptions that exist right now, because the fact of the matter is that groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda, the faith is part of the equation. There's no denying that. There is a religious dimension there. But it's important to stress that their interpretation of Islam is by no means straightforward. It's by no means literalistic. It involves convoluted reasoning. It involves, taking certain well-known principles and finding ways to get around them. And in the end, you're left with an interpretation of Islam not shared by the vast majority of Muslims. You know, there are many devout Muslims who would actually say that it's because of their religion that they are not violent. that they restrain themselves. They might believe that there is a time and place for warfare, but there are rules of war, and so on. So I think one of the major misconceptions I think we have to address head on is this idea that the only good Muslim is a dangerous one, and I think that's very dangerous. Like the only true Muslim is a dangerous one, and I think that's a very dangerous misconception.
Muhammad Khalil, thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you, Gordon.
Muhammad Khalil is a professor of religious studies at Michigan State University, also director of the Muslim Studies Program and adjunct professor of law. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.